Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We want to give some love to all of our sponsors. I had a really long conversation with Todd Schuller about crab cakes this week. You may want to check that out. And check our friends at Fadley's out. You can ship those crab cakes anywhere in the world. And, of course, our friends at State Fair doing it up. El Guapo has incredible stuff going on there with a little tequila tasting this weekend. We encourage everyone to go out, support our local sponsors. And as well, of course, Moeller & Gary Realty. You can find Jeff Moeller at Baltimore Positive. Talking real estate and you for springtime. Don, I know you've been wanting to get Luke back on the program. I'm going to turn the floor over to you. Every day is a busy day at the New York Times. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing. We welcome back New York Times reporter Luke Broadwater. And Luke, last time I looked, we chatted back in June and you were on your way to the Times. I think we thought the election would be a bit strange and a bit stressful. I guess anything we thought at that time is an understatement. And then last week, looking at the TV and watching all my news feeds, and boom, big breaking story by Luke Broadwater in the New York Times. You were all over the cable talking about these connections of Republican lawmakers to radical groups across the nation. And I have to tell you, Luke, that reporting took my breath away. So I'm just going to shut up. We've got limited time because there's so much going on down there in the Capitol. Nestor and I are going to shut up and ask you just to walk our listeners through that article again and some of the findings that you found, because it really did get my attention.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me again, guys. After the Capitol riot, and I was here that day. I was in the building for, you know, the siege on the Capitol.
We're not going to let you just gloss by that, by the way. Just say, yeah, I was there.
Talk about the article.
We'll come back to that after the article.
We can come back to that, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
There was, you know, frankly, a lot of the members of the House on the Republican side, the far right members, we don't give a lot of attention to in the New York Times. We don't interview them. They say quacky things. They say weird things. But and I think that's true of most public bodies, right? There's always like some backbencher who says nutty stuff and the press just ignores him and like interviews the serious people in the room. But after the, you know, after the riot, after the attack on the Capitol, it became very clear that we couldn't really ignore these guys any longer because they were stirring up the flames of conspiracy, the flames of hatred, the flames of racism, and they're sitting members of Congress. Right after the insurrection, there were some allegations from some of the Democrats in Congress that they had seen members, House Republican members, giving tours to people that may or may not have been involved in the attack in the days ahead of time. So we set out to look into that. We have not found evidence that there were these so-called reconnaissance tours. But in the course of the investigating of some of the far-right members' records, we came across a number of very concerning connections. In particular, we looked at connections to the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, and the Proud Boys, which are all far-right militia groups. And then we also looked at connections to the conspiracy theory and the people who believe in it of QAnon. And, you know, we found meetings, members of Congress, far-right members of Congress going to meetings with these groups. We saw them posing for pictures. We saw them appearing in promotional material together. Really, a lot of this stuff wasn't very hard to find. You just had to start looking into some of these far-right members' records. I led the article with Congressman Paul Gosar from Arizona, who had met earlier with the Oath Keepers out in Arizona. And they had asked him, are we headed for a civil war? And he told them, we're already in one. We just haven't started shooting yet. And so you see this type of violent rhetoric and this type of apocalyptic belief system that's sort of infecting the right wing of the Republican Party. And so we decided to shine a light on it. It's interesting because since this article came out, I've received a number of emails and tips from other about other members of Congress who weren't in this article. So I believe we're somewhere close to about 10 members of Congress who have direct ties to extremist groups. Obviously, Congress is taking steps against one of those members right now, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. There's going to be a vote today on whether to strip her of her committee assignments. So, you know, I think everyone is looking once again at these members that you maybe thought were just kind of far out there and realizing the danger of some of these extremist beliefs and associations.
Luke, you all really highlighted, I'll call the leaders of the band. You talked about Gosar, you talked about Boebert, you talked about Green.
Hawley?
I would throw, now you didn't look at the Senate, right? You looked at the House.
Well, just the House.
See, the thing is, we want to draw a distinction. There is an important, there's a good argument to be made that by going down this path of embracing Donald Trump's conspiracy theory and his lie that the election was stolen, even though they knew better, that Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz gave rise to the rally that day that led to the insurrection. But we were not able to find direct connections where Josh Hawley met with the Oath Keepers or met with the Three Percenters or you know, was on the QAnon radio show or something. So their involvement is more of raising objections to the election when they know full well the election was legitimate, and they were doing it as a way to attempt to ingratiate themselves with President Trump's base, who some of whom is obviously radicalized. I mean, you saw that on January 6th.
Well, Luke, that's the point that I'm fascinated with right now and trying actually to focus on in my own exploration, and that is trying to come up with the answer as to why. And let's drill for a minute on Kevin McCarthy, and I'm interested in your insights, because recently, obviously, by the time this airs, there will have been a Republican caucus meeting. It's been widely reported that in that meeting, Marjorie Taylor Greene got a standing ovation. I saw Adam Kinzinger interviewed. He said she did not, regardless of what's coming out of there, did not offer an apology. Kevin McCarthy comes out of that meeting, and even though he has spoken on QAnon numerous times publicly, I mean, there's video, as they say, roll the tape. There's video of Kevin McCarthy talking about QAnon in the past.
Well, the intellectual dishonesty is baked into it, right? I mean, literally.
Right. So then he comes out today, recently after the caucus meeting, and he pretends he doesn't even know how to pronounce it. He calls it QAnon or whatever. You know, I'm not sure what it is. You're smiling. Nestor's calling it intellectual dishonesty.
Well, that's baked into the cake.
What is driving this? Luke, you guys, I know, are trying to cover this. And here's the discussion I have, and I want you to weigh in. Is it fear of Trump? Is it their belief that the base is now significant to the party and they can't compete if the base takes a walk and forms a Patriot Party? Or are they silently sympathetic to these extreme views and trying to support people who say what they would like to say but can't? It's a mouth load. What do you think?
So I think, you know, the problems in the House Republican caucus are very deep. I don't think we see the same level of problems in the Senate. But in the House, I do think you have radicalized members. I think you have true believers in the House that are radicalized, that are extremists themselves. They share the belief system of extremists. They believe in 100% complete loyalty to Trump. He could commit any crime no matter what. If he tells them the election was stolen, if he says the Proud Boys are good, if he says the militias are good, they will march along with them. They're completely radicalized. I do think there are others, probably more than true believers, who are making what has to be described as a cowardly calculation that instead of leading, instead of being a leader and telling people, no, that's a lie, that's not true, we're not going to do that, and show leadership, they've chosen another path, which is, if I dare stand up to Donald Trump, if I dare stand up to his mob, I'm going to go down, and so I can't. And there'll be somebody else with even less ethics right behind me who will stab me in the back and take my leadership post. And so that's what they're all terrified of, that Trump and his mob cannot be cannot be defeated at the polls. It does really speak to the place we are at in America, which is these information silos, conspiratorial beliefs, an atmosphere of believing whatever Trump says, whatever his right-wing outlets repeat for him, and then not believe, and then choosing to believe that rather than reality.
Well, they are people who just don't really care to believe in facts, right? I mean, they've moved so far off the train of what a fact might be that I have lots of people like this in my life. We all do to some degree, not as many as I thought it maybe I had before, but the money that funds this and term limits and the NRA, look, because you're saying, well, these Proud Boys, where are they getting their money for to do all of this and then to sort of radicalize and move together into Washington, which you were in the middle of a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's, you know, there's this overlap. It's interesting because what's become of the Republican Party? Because, you know, I think a lot of people still think of the Republican Party as a party of principles and a party of, you know, Chamber of Commerce and that sort of thing.
Well, they've been running Reagan out for 40 years. That's when you that's right. What it is, right?
And I do think, like, the majority of the senators are that type of party, I think. In the House, though, they've allowed that culture of the House to become just completely Trumpist. And so there are some people like Adam Kinzinger left in the House who say, no, that's not actually being a conservative, what you're talking about. That's being an insane person. And but they're growing fewer and fewer in the House. I did think it was interesting last night that at the vote on Liz Cheney, because it was done by a secret ballot, they were able to keep her in, because when people didn't have to put their names by it and go on TV and risk a Trump attack, they stood by Liz Cheney. So I think it can be done, but it has to be done in secret for lots of these guys to have principles.
And what is a Trump attack at this point? What could a Trump attack be? What does that involve at this point?
Well, I think in many ways it's the fear that he still has the vast majority of your voters on his side, and that if you dare do something to cross him, you're done. You're going to be primaried. You're going to be someone even further to the right than Marjorie Taylor Greene or Lauren Boebert, or someone will come in and you'll be voted out. And the House lives in constant fear of losing elections because they're every 2 years. And because of the way the House is gerrymandered, most of the races are not trying to appeal to the middle. There are a few like that, but most of them are trying to appeal to the base of the party.
Welcome to Andy Harris. Welcome to one.
Right.
Yeah. And I would argue, and Luke, you live this as a Maryland reporter. We've seen it. Nestor alludes to one district. We talk about other districts. I would say this is what screams out for a federal solution to gerrymandering. I don't want to oversimplify an issue. And you can't do it, I believe, on a state-by-state basis. You can't unilaterally disarm if other states aren't going to fix gerrymandering. But the fact that we do have such extreme districts, and what I mean by that is safe, it's a better word than extreme, such safe districts, it does appear to be a real impediment to moderation. I mean, is that your sense as well? Is that these, like what gets lost here, Luke, Gosar that you mentioned got 70% of the vote in Arizona 4. He got 278,000 votes. Matt Gaetz got 70% of the vote, 282,000 votes. Marjorie Taylor Greene, 70% of the vote, 250,000. Yeah. They have a tremendous amount of support.
Well, Democrats don't even run in those races. I mean, you know, because those states are so gerrymandered. I mean, those are what you say, like plus 20 or plus 25 seats, districts. So any Republican on the ballot is going to win that seat, right? It's just a matter of which Republican is going to come out of the primary. And I do think that's why the incentives in the Senate are different. The incentives of the Senate, you have to win statewide. Usually that means you have to appeal to some semblance of Democrats and independents. You have a 6-year term, so you're not constantly worried about being primaried a year from now or 2 years from now. And, you know, the other elephant in the room is that, you know, it's not like just simply an ideological battle here. It's not like the Democratic Party where you can say, oh, they're going to move too far to the left on policy. You know, the policies are going to be too progressive. This is about it almost isn't even a real policy thing. It's about, are you in complete loyalty to one man? And if you are completely loyal to this one man, that's the test. It doesn't matter what the policy is. If he says a lie, do you believe the lie and march with it no matter what the truth is? And if you're willing to do that, then that's the extreme of the Republican Party right now, which is not at all about policy. It's about it's almost cult-like. And you see the arguments from defense attorneys coming out of the Capitol riot. They're almost all saying things like, he believed in a cult, he's essentially a member of a cult, he believed whatever Trump said. He believed in QAnon. He believed in the election fraud. And he marched down to the Capitol because he believed in his heart that these Satan worshipers and pedophiles and government were stealing the election from the man that God chose to run our country. Like, this is this crazy belief system. And, you know, a lot of these guys are feeling regret right now. I'm reading interviews with people who say, my client was fed a bill of lies. The QAnon shaman who marched into the Capitol and sat in the president's chair in the Senate is now feeling regret, according to his attorneys.
So. And not eating organically, from what I understand.
Yeah. I mean, and the other, you know, in this article, as we were researching it, the other thing that sort of stood out is how the big lie of the election theft and Trump was able to unite right-wing groups, extremist groups who would have never known each other, would have never met, never. I mean, we're talking about militias from the West with Proud Boys from the South, with QAnon conspiracy theorists from the East Coast. You know, this is a hodgepodge of every extremist group at law enforcement, whatever one investigate, all in one place. They all brought them together.
And they had their cell phones on and video open, right? Literally.
Yeah. I mean, it would be funny in some ways if it wasn't so terrible. I mean, you know, you look at some of these guys who came in the Capitol that day, they were obviously, sad stories of suckers, but, 140 police officers got injured. One got beat to death. One guy's going to lose an eye.
Luke, can you tell us your story? Because we haven't asked that yet.
People with concussions.
Right. Like, yeah. I want to pick up on Nestor's point as well, Luke, because we know you a little bit. We know your backstory. We know you're a son. We know you have a good relationship with your mom and dad, your in-laws. You spend time there. You're a husband. You're a dad. You, as Nestor said at the beginning of the interview, you said, I was in the Capitol building. I'm going to start with the simplest of questions when I ask you to describe that day. Were you scared? And did you text your mom and dad and your wife and saying, there's some bad stuff going down here?
I don't think I was scared in the moment. I think I was really angry. I think as I look back now and realize how close we were, that's scary. Like, the more and more stuff that comes out that I learn about it, where you learn that you were 1 minute away from the mob, or if I had stopped on a wrong floor, I would have been right in the middle of the mob. When the mob broke in, I was in the Senate chamber. You're not allowed to bring your cell phone in the Senate chamber. And they locked the doors and they were sort of screaming at us, get in or out, in or out. And I had to run out. I tried to grab some of my stuff and run back in. And anyway, so I didn't have my cell phone with me at first. And so I wasn't able to text people. And so when I came out and I did get my cell phone, there were like just tons of messages like, where are you? Are you safe? Like, so I was texting people back. They in the Senate chamber, you could hear the mob outside. Amy Klobuchar at one point spoke up and said, they just shot somebody. There's been a shooting. And I think that was at that time over on the House side, the police had shot one of the rioters. So that sort of sent a chill through the room. They started, a lot of these senators are older, and so they started escorting them out quickly, and they had to hold Mitch McConnell by the arm, and other people as they're walking him out. And we're sort of wondering up in the press gallery, like, what's going to happen to us? And so people were shouting out, where should we go? And so they said, like, go to the tunnels. And so we come out, we're in an elevator. I didn't realize at the time, if we had stopped one floor down, we would have been right in the middle of the mob. So we bypassed the mob and got down to the tunnels. You could see the mob outside through the windows, trying to break in, you know, smashing up bike racks, being very violent. We were sort of ushered through the tunnels, through a safe room. I was walking, you know, right alongside a lot of the senators, and there were sort of phalanxes of police set up where, you know, to block off the mob from getting to us. Then all of a sudden you start seeing like the artillery arrive, right? You start seeing the FBI come in, you start seeing men with military gear and huge guns, and they start clearing the building.
I really did wonder how they got the people out. I mean, like, to this, I'll never.
Yes.
It's incredible that these people walked out too. Like, it's just that there really wasn't more carnage.
They brought in the reinforcements, and you could see like when like a phalanx of the DC Metropolitan Police came in with SWAT gear, they just started like knocking down the rioters. Boom, boom.
That didn't show up on my Facebook page.
Yeah, because the Capitol Police were completely overwhelmed. They were not properly equipped for this day. They didn't have the right resources, the right equipment. It was a complete disaster. And we're learning, you know, more and more about the intelligence they had at the time, that there were white supremacists in the crowd. There were militia in the crowd. They knew that. They knew they'd be armed, and they knew they wanted to attack the Capitol. But for some reason, they didn't take it seriously. They couldn't believe that it would actually happen, so they didn't staff up for it. And, you know, we're hearing different tales from different law enforcement officials about who said, don't bring in the guard first. There's still a lot of confusion about that. I think a lot of blame is resting on the sergeant at arms who declined the first offer to ask for the guard,
who was fired the next day, right, Luke?
Absolutely. They were fired the next day, and they also misrepresented to Congress, because they told the chair of the appropriations committee that they would have the guard on standby, and they didn't. So you know, that was a disaster. But they did eventually clear the building. I think it took about 3 hours to clear the building. And the leadership had been sequestered off into a different space. And then I remember Chuck Schumer came walking back in and told to the press 8 p.m. And so eventually they announced, you can go, like, you're clear. And so we all walked back through the tunnel system, and I was walking right along next to the aides carrying the Electoral College ballots, which, you know, the mob had tried to break in and potentially burn or destroy or steal. They're obviously symbolic, but they were symbolic of our democracy. And and the senators really felt like, we have to vote tonight. I don't care how late it is, because we can't allow the mob to delay this election.
Luke, I thought that was one of the most important decisions that the Congress has made in my lifetime, that I don't care if it's 3 a.m. We're going forward with this thing. I know you have to run. There's so much going on down there. I hope we can have you back. We're with Luke Broadwater, by the way, outstanding congressional reporter, New York Times. Hope we can have you on regularly to walk us through the next few months, because I think it's going to be like Mr. Toad's wild ride. I don't think any of us know what's coming down. Real quick, Luke, if you don't mind, if you're not comfortable with this, feel free to pass. But so many of us have families, and we try to make everything about family. What time did you get home on January 6th?
5 a.m. 5 a.m.
So you didn't get home on January this. Oh yeah, you did. No, you didn't. You got home on the 7th.
Got home on the 7th at 5 a.m. Yeah,
I used to get home at 5 a.m., but it was a late night in Miami. Right. It wasn't a night at the Capitol like that. Luke.
Yeah,
Describe that moment when you walk in.
After we came back that night from the tunnels, a lot of the senators who had been going down this wrong path. And I'm using right and wrong here very clearly. I don't, you know, see, people say I'm biased, that's fine. But I think there's a right and a wrong in this situation. Going down the wrong path of questioning the election results because they thought it would ingratiate them to the Trump base. They saw that they had done wrong. And so they backed off those objections. But Josh Hawley went forward and he is still objected. And so that caused us to stay there another 4 hours when we could have been going home safely debating these false claims of election fraud.
And he believes that's going to buy him the next election in Missouri.
And
the presidential nomination.
His own colleagues were very angry at that. Right. And they had been angry before, but this was really, even after he saw what this lie had done to the country, that he kept going forward with it, I think a lot of people found that very disgusting.
Well, Kelly Loeffler that night, Luke, and then we'll take you back and to 5 a.m. and let you get out of here so you can record the news. Yeah. But Kelly Loeffler that night, I can remember saying to my wife when she got up and dropped her objection, I said, she's actually scared. I said, she's still, and I respect it. I don't agree with anything Kelly Loeffler ran on or stood for. But I said, there's a woman who was truly terrified today and said,
it's time for me to get out of politics and go count my money.
Enough. I'm done. So
I think that's right. I think a lot of people saw like this. We thought this was fun. We thought this was a game. It's not a game anymore.
Not a game.
When you lie and tell people something and spread this big lie and it puts people's lives in danger ultimately because they believe it and they want to storm the Capitol and they're chanting hang Mike Pence and they want to murder the media and all the things they said. Like this has gone too far.
It's 5 a.m. and your family can finally exhale. Describe that moment when you walk in after this incredible 24 hours.
Well, my kids were asleep, obviously, but they, Jen got up and, you know, I had been texting with them, you know, I'm coming home, you know, it's fine. Like I'm safe now, that kind of thing. So I don't think that they, hopefully they weren't that terrified, I think, you know, I honestly had a lot of trouble sleeping after that. I didn't sleep that night. And then I just went into working the next day. And then and I slept only like 1 hour the night after that and maybe 2 or 3 hours the night after that. But it took about a full week before I started to be able to sleep again.
Traumatic, dude. Come on, right? I mean, traumatic me thinking about it on your behalf. Don, as well.
That's funny, Nestor. I was going to say, we got to let Luke run. My stomach actually gets in a knot when he describes it. Luke, you're doing great work down there, making us all proud. And we follow you on Twitter. I encourage everybody, subscribe to the New York Times. It's not that expensive. Follow Luke Broadwater on Twitter. Let's get some facts, know what's going on. Luke's going to come back and join us periodically to update us on this crazy nation. Nestor, how about taking us out of here?
Yeah, I'm used to calling you Baltimore Sun, so I got to make sure I don't do that the wrong way. Appreciate you, brother.
Love the Sun. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
He is in a phone booth inside the walls of the Capitol right now. We appreciate you, Luke. Thank you very much. New York Times, Don Mohler. I'm Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking about important stuff in Baltimore Positive.